All right, welcome back to this week's edition of the Rock and Roll Ghost Podcast. This week we have filmmaker Baylen Schneider. This is your first film, right? Out of Time, The Material Issue Story?
Yeah, my first feature, so.
Yeah. It's a documentary about the Chicago power pop band Material Issue, their career and the passing of their lead singer, Jim Ellison. And features a lot of really great interviews with a lot of people that were around at the time the band was at its peak. Baylen, welcome to the show. Hope you're doing well today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're a pretty young guy. You're obviously were not born when Material Issue were around. What was your start? What was the first time you heard of them? Or heard them, and what about them spoke to you?
I think that's it's always cool. That seems to be the first thing fans gravitate towards, like when they meet me or we're doing like a Q&A or something. I was like 16, I want to say. I was really young, and I think someone posted on like their Instagram story like Valerie Loves Me, the song, and I was like, oh, that's like a cool album art and a cool name of a song. So I think I listened to it and I got really into it. And then I was like getting into the record. And then I think my girlfriend at the time like bought me the CD from like our local like CD store in Lawrence, Kansas. I just like listened to the record a lot. And I like somehow knew the story. I don't know if it was like I was like just surfing the web and like as I do, I feel like. And I knew the story and I was like, thought it was a good idea to like do a little 8-minute YouTube documentary thing on them. And it kind of just evolved into what it is now.
Yeah. What was your first steps to doing something? I mean, you were in college and you were studying film. Is that correct?
Yeah. And it was funny because it was like, yeah, it was pretty much we like reached out to the band on like Facebook because they have like a booking manager, but obviously they're not like a full-fledged band anymore, so they don't have management anymore. So we like reached out to them on Facebook, and I think I texted Ted and I was like, hey, we're these kids from Kansas, we really want to do this thing on you. And I think it took a couple months, but eventually they agreed to do it. And like, we went up in December. We like drove to Chicago in December. It was freezing. And we interviewed the band and then Jeff Murphy and Jay O'Rourke. And that was like our first trip and like our first set of interviews, which kind of were like the framework of the whole film. I feel like Jeff and Ted's interviews are really important. Mike's the drummer, we re-recorded. That's not the original interview. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. So the interview with Ted is the original interview from when you went up there.
Yeah. He was like, actually, Ted's interview was the first one we ever did.
That's cool.
It was really thorough, which is what I think kept it in the film.
Yeah.
Same with Jeff Murphy. Although Jeff Murphy always has like very astute and I guess like long-winded explanations to things. So like pretty much you put Jeff in front of a camera and like you're fine.
Yeah. So what turned you to go from having an 8-minute film to deciding to expand upon that?
Yeah, I think it was like when we realized like larger people wanted to be involved. And also Jim's family, like getting Jim's family involved was definitely like this moment where it was a lot more intimate and like became kind of more of a complex story. And it's interesting because they're in the film at like, I feel like the two kind of, they're at the beginning and then they're at the end. It's not like they're this through line of the story, but they're definitely like the emotional catalyst of the story. And getting them was a big deal. Getting like Greg Kot and Jim DeRogatis on it also like I think made it was a lot easier to get like money. like producing wise, like to fund the film, which we needed a lot for licensing. It was easy to, you know, get more people interested in donating or giving money to the project solely based on the fact that like we had bigger names. And then like Steve Albini came and we interviewed Rick Nielsen and Gilby Clark and Liz Phair and et cetera, who didn't even end up being in the film. But I think having them in it like really like bolstered the financing of the project, I guess.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, you know, you brought up some people that were featured in the film in different ways, but you brought up three that you say you interviewed, but they didn't, you didn't know if you used the footage. One was Rick Nielsen, one was Gilby Clark, and Liz Phair. What about those interviews didn't fit with the final film as you saw it?
Yeah. Out of the three, I really liked Liz's the most, but it was just audio because it was like COVID. So it was like Zoom, right? And I just didn't like the idea of just kind of like having her like underneath photos. I feel like Liz has her moments in the film where like it's, you know, she gets her cred, like she's mentioned a lot. And I feel like just putting her in the film, like she was close with Jim and everyone kind of knows that. You know, if we did it on camera, it'd be different, but... And then in terms of like Gilby, it was just like, I don't know, technical difficulties, I think. But then also just like that section where Gilby kind of comes in is so fast. But it really did help with like research, like talking to Gilby and kind of and hearing his thoughts and stuff. And then same with Rick. It was just kind of like Rick really talked about the Chicago scene. So it was just really quick. It just didn't seem really like it fit. You know, there are a couple people who are in there who are just like in there for like one clip. You know, it was hard. Sometimes we'd be like, okay, how do we just put Rick in here for one clip? And just like wouldn't work, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure if maybe sometimes like with a documentary, sometimes the basics, the basic thing that people say might be said somewhere else, you know, maybe better, more, you know, or however, you know, more poignantly or whatever. I thought maybe that might be part of it, but yeah, it's, I guess it's gotta be hard to whittle all those interviews down to something that tells a compelling story that doesn't, you know, have any, you know, slack in it, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. I think also we were dealing with that like hour time slot. Like the film's relatively short for a feature. And I think that was like partly like us learning as filmmakers, because like most people who worked on it were really young. And I feel like you can even tell with like the interview shots, you can see our arc, like you can see us growing. There's some earlier on interview shots, like Jim's sister is a big one that I dislike, where it was just like, you know, it was our second really time filming ever, like professionally. And we were like 18. And also film school in Kansas is vastly different than, you know, LA film school, for example.
Right.
But yeah, you can really see like the growth towards the end with like a shot like Joe Shanahan, the owner of Metros, which I think is like one of the coolest shots in the film. Yeah, so there was definitely like a learning curve with everything, but for sure the visuals and in the story, there's a learning curve.
Yeah. Was there anybody that you wanted to talk to that you weren't able to get?
Yeah, a couple. A big one was Nash from Urge Overkill, who was like best friends with Jim. We got Eddie. You know, I think a little bit of like the Smashing Pumpkins. I talked to a couple of those guys, but nobody wanted to do an interview. I think the problem is like that was such like a drug haven back in the day, right? And now all these people are old or they have kids or they have jobs or lives. And it's like re-acknowledging a lot of that is like, you know, talking about probably the most tumultuous time in your life. Because the material issue were really in that early, in those early days. So I think, or it was just really emotional for them. So someone like Nash was a big one.
Why did he choose not to be in it? Just because he didn't want to talk about Jim being that close of a friend, or?
No, I don't know. I've heard he wanted to be in it. I just don't know if it was like we ever connected. You know, like I know the Urge guys through their manager. So it might have just been like he just didn't want to do anything at the time. So he wasn't even taking requests. I don't know. I know he has a lot of love for Jim and would only say good things. And obviously they were really tight, but it could just be that, you know, wasn't in the right place at the right time kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I hear you. What was the most surprising thing that you learned when you were making the film?
I don't know. I think it's that theme of like two things, I guess. I think the first thing is like this theme we really have been focusing on, which is like material issue opened the door for like a lot of Chicago bands. Like really, I think a lot of these artists like Billy Corgan or Liz Phair, Veruca Salt, you know, would say that like material issue was that band that opened the doors. Like without them, there would have been no like putting Chicago on the map. And I think that's really important because I think it even continued like later down the line, like Smoking Popes and Fall Out Boy and Alkaline Trio and Rise Against. Like they all really followed that material issue model. Also, material issue were fronted by like the most enigmatic lead singer ever. And like he was constantly like he booked the club while he was in a band. Like he was constantly booking smaller bands, or he'd go to Indiana and he'd invite some Indiana opener to open for them, even when they were on a major. And I think, you know, it was this idea that like he really liked uplifting people. And Jim had this really like bad reputation or having a large ego kind of reputation. But in reality, it was like he really loved music and he loved like Chicago and the scene he was in. And he was really the godfather of that. And that, like, at first kind of uncovering all that was probably the thing that I was like, whoa, this is a lot more deep than just like a band that made good songs. So that was probably the thing that like surprised me the most in the way that I had to really figure out how to like say that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, there was, I mean, Material Issue were a band that I definitely heard of. I mean, I was a big listener to WXRT before alternative kind of broke, and there were all these bands that you would hear on XRT that you would only hear there. You couldn't possibly hear them anywhere else. You'd hear The Cure, you'd hear Depeche Mode, you'd hear Material Issue, what have you. And it was, like I said, it was right before alternative kind of hit. Obviously, Material Issue came out with their album International Pop Overthrow before Pumpkin's Gish debut. So yeah, you're right. I mean, they were definitely ahead of their time in terms of being the start of the scene. But they were still a band that I, even though I knew that they were played on the radio and they had a certain amount of success, they were st still felt like I don't know, I wouldn't say a smaller band, but they seemed just underrepresented somehow. And I don't know why. I mean, we knew a lot about them in Chicago because they were Chicago, but you know, at large, I don't, I mean, I know they were played on MTV, but I personally don't ever remember seeing a video of theirs on MTV until Kid and the Waitress, which is really weird. So
Yeah, I
I
mean,
think that's a matter of like the label just not doing enough for them.
yeah, what's crazy is, you know, the band's management team have all kind of gone on to be the leaders in their industry. Like Jeff and Peter have managed some of the biggest acts of all time and probably had the biggest management company of the 2000s. And then Melissa, who was on the band's management team, now owns probably the biggest PR firm in Hollywood. And it's kind of crazy because you can kind of see them laying the groundwork for that with Material Issue, which was their first band. I think Peter maybe had dipped his toes in ministry, but really Material Issue was like Jeff's and Peter's first band. And what's interesting to me about that is like, you're right, like it was really kind of like a fumble by the label. I think the problem was like Mercury at the time had a bunch of like I think hard rock and like, you know, not Material Issue, no alternative acts. So like Material Issue was their alternative act. And like you said, they're not really an alternative act in the most traditional sense. Like that first song that broke on XRT, Renee Remains the Same, is really like a to me, like, it's Brit poppy, like,
yeah,
60s. So it's like, yeah, I think the label just didn't know what to do. And then I think Jim was hard to work with. I think Jim, by the third record, really, really soured the relationship with the label. And but I even think going to the second record, I think Jeff, the manager, Jeff Quantinance, and the label really wanted the band to rush into the studio and make a second record, right? There's like this year gap between 91 and 92. And, you know, with that, the second record, Destination Universe, there's really good songs on that record, like really some of Jim's best writing, but it's just not that, it's not the best record. I was just talking to Mike about it, and this is I guess my opinion. Like the record sounds very too polished. They're playing on a click track. I personally think, and I think a lot of people think, you know, they should have gone and recorded with a different producer. Yeah. But I think it was Jim and Ted being very comfortable and wanting to be with Jeff Murphy.
Yeah.
It's like really when you listen to that second record, there's no like single. Like, I think the thing people loved about the first record is like there was a ballad, there was Very First Lie, but really you had it fronted by like Diane and Valerie Loves Me and Renee Remains the Same. And then the third record, same thing. There's like five amazing rock songs, and then I Could Use You being a ballad. But with that second record, it's like a lot of soft songs, like Everything and Next Big Thing are two of the biggest songs. But then like What Girls Want, that video sucks. I've never really talked to that band about it, but that music video is awful.
Yeah.
And it's awful for any generation, but I imagine it was especially awful for 90s MTV. It's just garbage. And the song is really good. Like you'll hear the song. It was on like a Bears game last year, I remember. You'll hear it played. It's like pretty popular, but the marketing for that. And the whole album art for Destination Universe, I think, was really rushed by the label. I just don't think they knew what to do. Where, like, I think, obviously, like, Nirvana's label, like, you could tell that was, like, kids working on it. Like, young people in the industry. Like Nevermind has some of the best, like, rollout ever. Same with Pearl Jam. Same with Melancholy by the Pumpkins. Like, where really there's this, like, cool aesthetic, and Material Issue did not have that. Especially for the second record.
Yeah, so it definitely seems like Mercury was a major part of the problem. You know, I think probably the most fascinating moment is that, you know, I remember when Jim died, I think because I knew his reputation of being this very upbeat guy, and he was not, I wouldn't say a scenester, but he was like a guy, he was always around, you know, that's what I heard. Like, he was always, you know, at shows. He was always doing stuff with music. I listened to Jim and Greg back in the early days. I think even Jim with, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. He wrote for the Chicago Reader. But the Sound Opinion dates back so far back at this point that, you know, it just, I think it was on Q101 and then it was on XRT and, yeah, they went to NPR and now they just do their own thing. But they would always hurl, you know, Material Issue. They absolutely loved them. Obviously, they're in the movie. But when he died, it was just such a shock because when anybody kills himself, it's hard to deal with if you know them at all. But especially for him, I have to imagine a lot of people that knew him, just there was that disconnect.
Yeah, I think like, you know, we interviewed like 40 people and I'd say like everybody checks that box. Like some people are like, oh, we saw it coming, but like they didn't see it coming at the same time.
Right.
I think looking back on it in retrospect, they saw it coming, but they didn't at the time. And I think it like makes sense. Like if you look at like a Kurt Cobain or like a Chester Bennington as a good example in the modern day, like the songs that they were writing were deeply complex and they were obviously struggling with the fame aspect of it, especially Kurt, where like Jim was writing bubbly pop songs about falling in love and loved the fame aspect of the band.
Yeah.
And Like, sure, on Telecomando Americano, which I guess came out after the band, after Jim had died, even though he wrote those tracks, there's a lot of, I think, red flags per se on that record. Like, what if I killed your boyfriend?
Right.
I think the way I understand it, and obviously, like, a lot of people like to talk about Jim's death, so like I feel very like studied in that era of his life. The way I understand it is it was quick. It wasn't like this like 2 year period where Jim was really upset. I think after they lost the record deal with Mercury, they were like, Lena, let's go out and get another record deal. And I think maybe that was a big push by Zelenko, where like Jim not as much, but I think he was dealing with like a complex mix of problems.
Right.
It was this girlfriend who like I think people kind of in the material issue circles put too much of an emphasis on. I don't think it was like this girl that broke his heart. Like that really shattered him, I think. But you know, like a lot of people in the circles are like it was her fault, or I think felt that way at the time.
Right.
And I think it was just like, you know, he really struggled with his parents' divorce at the time, even though he was in his 30s, which is like, you know, now I think you would look at as like Jim had a lot of mental illness, and I think the band really, you know, thinks that. You know, like he had really spouts of mania. Like, and I think,
Okay.
you know, someone struggling with the divorce as much as he did in his 30s is definitely, you know, analyzed today a lot different. And then it was also, you know, getting dropped from the label and not being this like major label deal. And then a lot of people were really cruel. You know, Jim had that big ego where he was like, we're the best band ever, we're gonna get there. He kind of had that Oasis thing, right? Which I think played into why they were so great. But I think a lot of the bands that were like in the Chicago scene that never made it really gave it back to them. Like, I think Jim died and they really rubbed it. I mean, sorry, Jim lost the record deal and they like really rubbed it in his face. And I think that probably contributed to it. And then, you know, like a lot of people in the circles are like, you know, like you think Material Issue was a clean band, but certainly Jim was not clean at the time of his death. And
Yeah.
of course that contributes to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a perfect storm kind of thing. Like, just, he decided on he instead of trying to figure out a way around it for that day, he just couldn't see it and went in. That's usually how stuff like that happens. It's so different from like somebody like Cobain who pursued it repeatedly.
No, I do think the gym thing was just like, yeah, it was that night. Like, I think the one thing that's not in the film and it's kind of intimate is I think a lot of people had a voicemail on their box. And I think that's what's really sad is I think Jim called a lot of people that night to try to be like, come over and like come play poker, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, I think it was just like late at night. And like, you know, I think it was like one of those things where like it happens with me. We're like, if I'm having an anxious day or, you know, like you call a bunch of your friends the day of because like your day was bad and now you want to make plans for the night and no one answers or that kind of thing.
I know
And
how
I
you
think
feel.
with that storm, it's like, oh well, he was like, I'm alone. It's like reality, no, like you weren't alone in the slightest. So yeah, I think that was like an unfortunate thing. But yeah, I just think it was like the band has been really open about this and in a really poignant way. Like, if there were the same mental health resources as there were today, I think it would be different. And like that was kind of a big aspect is you could probably like now, I think one of the bandmates or one of Jim's friends or family would be like, oh, Jim, you need help. But it was the 90s, like they didn't see that. There
No,
was no discussion.
I can vouch for that. I mean, being about the same age as, Jim and the guys, and suffering through my own mental health issues, it's like you know, it wasn't until the 2000s where I even realized I could go on medication to, you know, perhaps help. And I was a mess in the 90s, you know, mentally. And a lot, everybody would always pretty much, except for my mom, you know, was always understanding. She knew, but like everybody else always would like suck it up, you know, I don't know what you have to complain about, you know, and all that stuff. And it's because people didn't know better, you know?
Yeah, for sure. No, I think, yeah, no, I think a lot of people were like, well, why Jim, why would Jim be sad? But it's like, in reality, like, I mean, losing a record deal, like, I felt like he thought his career was over. You know, they had booked him a flight to LA to write for, I think, Marshall Crenshaw. Okay. And he had done some writing for other people. He wrote a song with Liz Phair for the film Stealing Beauty.
Yeah.
I think they all thought Jim would have had a really long career in songwriting for other people if it wasn't Material Issue, right, or kept Material Issue going. And I think Mike really wanted
to. Yeah, I mean, he could have done both. It's amazing how, like, people used to break up bands because they didn't think they could do their thing and do the band. And nowadays, everybody kind of has figured out how to circumnavigate, you know, all that stuff.
No, I think if you look at like kind of the modern 2000s models, it's like, okay, a good example now is like Jack Antonoff. Like,
yeah,
he's kind of done everything. I mean, he was in this band Steel Train, and then Steel Train didn't work out. Then he was in Fun, and then they won a bunch of Grammys, and then he left Fun, and then he started Bleachers, and then Bleachers is huge, and now he's producing for everybody.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, where it's just like, I'm going to keep going. I think Jim had so much identity in Material Issue because they were kind of that first successful Chicago band.
Yeah.
And he wanted to stay in Chicago, where I think Mike was like, hey, we got to move to LA. Like, there's more opportunity there.
Yeah.
Whereas now, like, you know, you can be successful in Chicago because of TikTok and Instagram and the scene that's in Chicago. Back then, it was like, you know, a lot of the opportunity was in LA.
Yeah.
And I think all that kind of contributed to, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people too, I mean, you know, I think further down the road, I think like somebody like an act like the Pumpkins, who Billy still lives, you know, I think Jimmy and Billy still live in, you know, the Chicago area.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people figured out when they reached a certain amount of success that they could do what they want, that LA was, you know, LA, New York, whatever. It was just the beginning of that. But if he could have just, you know, maybe held on for a little bit longer, he could have seen it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think also too, Jeff Quantinetz, not Peter certainly, but Jeff Quantinetz, I think kind of like, in the most not trying to be offensive way, abandoned the band a little bit. And I want to be careful with how I say.
Well, he picked up, you mentioned it in the film, or they mentioned it in the film, that his next project was Korn.
Yeah.
And Korn ended up becoming a huge thing, you know?
Yeah. And I think that was the thing. And like, he really catapulted Korn into like getting the Backstreet Boys and J-Lo, and they had Michael Jackson, and then they had actors and just every huge musician ever. I mean, they just like blew up after the Korn thing. And I think the thing is I think Jeff was really, he moved to LA, and he was really focused on building his company. And I think, you know, Material Issue were on the road and getting money, and Jeff was kind of not doing everything he should.
Yeah.
Like, I think he probably felt annoyed by Jim's whole deal with the label. And then they're like, well, like, now they don't have a record deal. But it wasn't like a manager at the beginning of your career where they're really excited and they're like, okay, well, let's go get you another record deal then. And you're still the greatest thing. And it was two kind of albums that had done, like, objectively worse in the commercial space.
Yeah.
And so I think Jeff really was like, well, this Korn, this new metal thing is happening, and he blew that band up. I mean,
yeah,
instantly overnight. Yeah. And it's because Jeff is one of the most talented kind of mafia kind of guys, I think, where like he's kind of one of those managers that, like, you know, he has controversy. There's some like you know, scrappier elements than like a Peter Katsas.
Yeah.
Like the nice guy manager.
Well, that dates back to, I think a lot of people model managers on people like the right or wrong, like Colonel Tom Parker or Zeppelin's manager. I mean, the Zeppelin manager was notorious for going into record stores with a baseball bat and destroying your bootlegs, for God's sake. You know, it's like that was kind of like the whoever got made the most noise got kind of the was the go-to inspiration, I think, for a lot of managers.
Yeah, and I think, I think back then, though, it was different. It's like they could have one band and be successful. And I think Jeff kind of was that one of those first guys who was like, I want to build an empire.
Right.
And he did. And then, like, they had no experience managing actors, but then they got, like, Leo DiCaprio and a bunch of people. I think Vin Diesel and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And it was probably that first big management company. I mean, now you have some, like, Crush Music, a good example.
Yeah.
Who also started with, like, one band and built it into the biggest music management company ever. But, like, really, it was the firm and I think Jeff's vision.
Yeah.
That he built that thing into an absolute empire.
Yeah.
And also just because I think you have like good guy Peter on there too.
Yeah. There is a big difference in the two of them, that's for sure.
Yeah. So that's just interesting. I mean, I think, just going back to the Korn thing, I think it was like it weighed on the band. And I think at the time too, Ted was kind of done with it. I mean, like, Ted's like a family guy. I mean, he has a family. He has a job and he has a wife and he's happy. And I think, like, not that he didn't enjoy his time on the road and stuff, but it's like, you know.
Things could have come to a head in that regard, too, at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is like, maybe Ted had more insight. I don't know. I haven't really talked to him about it, but, like, into the idea that there was life after the band. And maybe Mike and Jim didn't.
Yeah.
Or didn't really have a plan. Or,
right.
You know.
Or we're just holding on too tight to the band.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're at that level of success, it's hard not to. And I think that's like culturally one thing I've tried to analyze about it is it's like, I don't know, they were on top of the world at like 18. Like Mike was so young and it's like, especially, you know, when I think they were like the first band in Chicago, it's like all the people around you, you know, all the girls, all the fans, all the people in Chicago being like, oh, you guys are the one that made it. They were celebrities. They were full on celebrities in Chicago. So that is probably a hard thing identity wise to like, at like 24, I don't know, however old Mike Cilento was. To be like, oh, well, it's all over. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what do I do now? Like, 24 is still relatively the start of most people's career. So, that's crazy, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing, too, in regards to Jeff and Peter, you know, the difference is that people also didn't have conversations like they do now. Everybody just kind of pushed everything off until it became a crisis. You know, and nowadays people know that you have to start, you know, bands like, you know, I think the most famous one that kind of shows the divide between the old and the new is when in that Metallica documentary where they, you know, they actually go to therapy. You know, it's like, because if they hadn't done that, that band wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just an interesting, it is really the, it's like, you know, it's like the Bible. It's like the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's like now everybody, you know, not that people don't fight, not that bands don't break up, but people have a better idea of how to handle interband, you know, dealings and all that.
Yeah, for sure. Or I think, you know, it could have also been like business-wise, like planting the fact that they wanted Jim to not like to do stuff outside of Material Issue.
Right.
But I just think it was also probably Jeff and Peter's lack of experience.
Yeah.
And I think at the time Jeff was like way more involved. I don't really know Peter's involvement at that point, but you know, Jeff was in charge. Jeff was the lead on Material Issue for sure. So I don't know like if at the time it came from this like unknowing how to like see a crisis or deal with it, or just like he saw it as a financial thing, like Materialist is doing worse, I'm picking up this new band, I kind of have to move on, I love those guys, but Jim's difficult. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't want to like sit here and act like Jim
was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, like, he made things worse for himself, and that's like sucks to say, but like someone told me, like, you know, with the third record, he like blew up on the label in like a label meeting.
Yeah.
And I think that he like went there in person. There was like a big argument. And I think that that really soured things. And Jeff tried to like stamp it out, but I think they were ready to drop him before the third record.
Yeah.
And the third record too is really amazing. It's like, I think their best work.
Yeah,
that's what the film's kind of about. But I think too, like, they definitely were more involved in the aesthetic, right? Like, the album art's really cool. Jim and Mike really wanted to call it Freak City Soundtrack. I think the soundtrack part really hurt them, because like, yeah, it would get organized with soundtracks at the record
right.
store.
Right.
And then one more thing is, I think the label didn't really care. Like, the music video for that's good. It's way more 90s in my opinion, especially the performance section of the music video. Mm-hmm. But I think the label didn't really care. I think they put
They probably thought at this point that they weren't gonna break the way the other bands at the time did.
Yeah, and also just like, oh, they're hard to work with. Why are we gonna? No one was really passionate about the third record, I think, on the label, because probably they were difficult, and they, you know. I always talk to the band about this. Everyone thinks that Going Through Your Purse should have been the first single, and I completely agree.
I remember hearing that argument back then too. I specifically remember Dear Goddess saying that that should have been the single.
Yeah. No, it's that song is great. I mean, there's so many amazing songs on that record.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is because a lot of those were like early, early Jim songs, like pre-International Pop Overthrow.
Yeah.
She's Going Through My Head on that record could have been a single. Echo Beach could have been a single. I Could Use You could have been a single, even though it's a ballad.
Yeah.
I think Kim is a good single, but it's like a third or fourth single.
Yeah.
You know, it's good. It's also just not a Jim Allison song, which I think they did.
Right, right. Which I didn't know, honestly, until the documentary, which was surprising to me. If I knew it, I forgot it. But because it feels like them.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting if you listen to the original version, because it's very Seattle. But it's like, yeah, and I think this might be in the film.
Some of it, yeah.
But they talk about how, where Mike Chapman talks about how it was the same, he kind of prompted them to do it because Debbie Harry ran into the studio with the nerves hanging on the telephone.
Right. She had
like the 45. And Mike was like, Blondie doing that song on Parallel Lines was like, made him bring it up to Materialist. It was like, well, do you have any covers? And I think Mike still has the Green Pajamas 45. Mm-hmm. And he were like, Jim and I just played the shit out of it. And then they did the cover, and arguably I like the cover better than the original. Mm-hmm. Materialist should kill it. I just don't think it was like really encompassed the whole record, and that,
right.
And that kind of led to it not doing well too.
And then that was the label's decision, of course. So.
Yeah. And maybe the management's, but also it's just like, you could tell, like, no one pushed that record hard. There was no, like, yeah. I mean, that was what, 94? So it was like, they could have really pushed that into the market, and they just didn't.
Yeah. Well, and the other cool thing, and you brought them up, I thought the most emotional moment, I wasn't expecting it to be the most emotional, the person to have the most emotional moment was Mike Chapman, the producer of you know, the last released, you know, studio album. He really seemed to still be holding on to guilt about not reaching out to Jim, and he feel it's obvious, he seems like he bears a burden of his loss somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was interesting too, when you asked earlier about being surprised. It's like, yeah, like that was another thing. A lot of people are still very guilty. And like in a very poignant way, like, you know, I'm friends with the band, but as a journalist, I can say that, like, you know, it's like the band doesn't really see each other a lot. Like, really, the only time Mike and Ted see each other is when I'm in the room with them. Yeah. Like, and they get along like brothers, and like, you know, they're family to me now at this point. But nobody talks for 30 years. And I think that just feeds on guilt. Like,
yeah.
The family in the band didn't talk really until the film was being made, or kind of towards the end of the film being made.
That's not a huge surprise. I mean, everybody seems very old school Chicago to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was really like, but yeah, no, a lot of people had guilt, and the Mike Chapman thing, especially, it was very beautiful. I just think Mike, for some reason, out of everything he's done,
right,
that record meant so much to him. And he loved that record, and I think he thought it was one of the best things ever, and so did the band. And I think that's what I'm saying. If that happened in the second record, like they had a new producer right away, maybe a gap between International Pop Over There Too, like did 2 more years. You know, it was like this 3-week period. They were recording in Chicago and going out every night with friends and family and making this amazing record with all these cool special guests. If that would have happened, second record, it would have blown up.
Yeah.
I just think it was like, so yeah, I think Mike was really guilty about it, because I think Jim was like emailing him or sending him letters, and he didn't respond, or he didn't respond in the way he thought he would. I think there's a lot of people like that,
yeah,
who maybe don't mention in the film, but were really guilty. And that was really very, really difficult emotionally to film, but also like how to tell in like a poignant way. Yeah. But no, well, Mike is such a great guy and such a like emotional guy. So
yeah, for me, that was the moment of the whole thing. Is I think it's making a documentary. I hate to say you live for a moment like that, but quite frankly, that moment is what you hope to achieve even multiple times in a documentary, that moment of extreme realness. Now, of course, you don't want to mine misery necessarily, but that one, it was such a unexpected thing. And for me, it connected me to the film more than I had already been connected to it.
Yeah, I think that for sure. I think the Mike Chapman thing makes the film for sure, unequivocally. His whole interview. I mean,
yeah,
like,
yeah, he was. And, I didn't know much. I knew who he was, but I don't think I'd ever seen him interviewed before.
Yeah, I mean, like, and that was like, it was hard. I can tell that story a little bit, but it was like interesting because, yes, it was like this thing where like I knew it was going to really make the film. It was a really small space. I was like a foot in front of him during the interview, mm-hmm. and I was like sobbing. It was like I only cried. I definitely teared up at a lot of people's interviews, but I only cried during Jim's mom's second interview and Mike Chapman's interview.
Yeah.
And of course, I was like, I gotta be professional. Like, this is a journalistic interview, but it was hard to sit there and not cry.
Yeah.
And Mike Chapman's family was in the room, so it was like especially difficult to just like watch him talk about it probably for the first time. But yeah. No, so getting Mike Chapman, I can say that real quick. Getting Mike Chapman on the film was funny. He's very reclusive and he lives in London. But when we interviewed him in like 2019 or whatever, 2018, he still had a house in Connecticut. I think since now he doesn't. He was like moving when we, he was getting ready to sell the house and move permanently to London where he's at now. And I knew he had a house in Connecticut. Someone told me that no one had his email. And he's not a public guy, so he doesn't have like social media or anything. And so I white paged his address and I called the house phone and his daughter picked up and I was like, I'm trying to find Mike Chapman. I'm doing a film on one of the records he made. And she's like, what record? And I was like, Material Issues Freak City soundtrack. And she's like, that's my favorite thing my dad's ever done. And that was like immediately, and Astrid's great. She's like my age. So it was like kind of cool in that way. But she's like, okay, I'll give you his email. And he was like, I'll be in the US for 3 days out of this whole year.
Yeah.
So we had like a very small window. So I think we skipped class in college and flew to New York and drove to Connecticut just for that interview. And it was like, I don't know, so important and so amazing. Yeah, it was insane. But it was just kind of funny because I think it was like, yeah, he's like not someone like that I think typically does interviews, but he's such a good interview. And that thing is like, I want to say like 3 hours. I just had questions and questions and questions. And I think that's like one of my best interviews I think still I've ever done in my career.
He was really good in it. And I mean, as somebody like that, you could probably talk for hours more about all the other stuff he's done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just an amazing career. And for the career he's had, he does not, you guys mentioned in the movie, you know, it gets referenced. He is not the guy you expect to, you know, to have done those records. He looks like a guy that's just going to go out on, like, I think somebody says, like, go out on his boat and, you know, go for a little sail or something. He's just a very, you know, average looking kind of dad guy.
Yeah. No, I love that little bit. I think that's funny.
You don't expect him to have hung around some, you know, kind of notorious, you know, artist back in the day.
Literally.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's just like a brilliant songwriter too. I mean, he's just done so much. And obviously I love Blondie. I guess there's literally Blondie poster right there.
Oh, okay. I didn't see, I can't see. Yeah. I can always see like half of it.
That's but, cool. Yeah. So yeah, I love that interview. And obviously other people get emotional, but I love, there's some good bits about that Jim's mom says.
Yeah.
And it guts me when I watch it still, but.
Yeah, she was really good as well. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did want to ask, where is the film at now? I know you did a screening here in Chicago at the Alamo Draft House, the new Alamo Draft House. Where is it? Are things going to end up? Are you coming out with it on video, or how's that working?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we waited kind of a year-ish to do the Alamo Draft House because we really wanted to be at the new Chicago ones. Like, we knew it was being made, and they wanted to play it, so we waited for them. So we did a week of screenings there. We kicked it off with a Q&A that went amazing. And then, so it's playing right now, like, in a lot of cities. It's playing Minneapolis, Columbus. It's playing Chicago. We're doing a Q&A with me, Matt Pinfield, Melissa, and the band here in LA at the Alamo Draft House on March 24th. It's going to play in Dallas, New York. We're getting a date. It's playing in Harrisburg. But there's probably going to be like at least 20 or 30 more dates announced of just like all around, especially in big markets where the band really did well. So it's going to continue to do this theatrical thing. And then we're doing this really cool Blu-ray package. I think it'll come out in July with some really cool stuff, some like extras. There's like this Smashing Pumpkins material issue poster that comes with the Blu-ray.
Oh, nice.
Liner notes by our friend Jim Ryan. And then we're doing, streaming after that. So probably I'm assuming that will be like fall or so. But we're really trying to do like, you know, my distributor's Factory 25, which I think is one of the coolest in the game. And we're really trying to do these like cool, you know, indie, keep it in theaters. I think people like watching it in theaters, which is weird because I'm not really a theater guy. I'm definitely more like watch at home kind of guy. But it is interesting that like every single time it's weird, I guess, seeing people cry to your film. That's very weird, but it's just like this very cool movie to see in theaters. So we're gonna do a big theatrical run, then Blu-ray, and then streaming, and there's merch out now. There's gonna be more collectibles and stuff, so that should all be pretty fun.
Great. And is there anything you're working on now as your next thing?
It's another music thing. but you know, the ups and downs of that. But
can you talk at all about what roughly what it's about?
It's about like a record label with a bunch of big bands. It's like five bands. It's probably all I can say.
Okay. All right.
But it'll be cool. There's some right. we filmed some in Chicago. Right. That'll be the hint.
Okay. I guess.
So right. I don't know. It still might never happen, but we're kind of
you're beginning work on it.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Well, yeah. I hope that goes well, and I'm really looking forward to what else you got going on, and keep on the lookout for, you know, out of time and material issue story in the theater in your city. And keep an eye out for, you know, if you're not near a major city, and you know, eventually it's going to be on video. So keep an eye out for that. And you know, Baylen, thank you very much for talking about.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to get to talk to somebody about their first film. It's just really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you have a good rest of your day, man.
You too, man. Thanks. All right,
bye.